Well, hello and welcome to the Smells Like Money podcast. Join me, Suzanne Chin Taylor, the doo-doo diva, as I interview guests who are making an impact on how we manage and operate systems for conveying and treating wastewater. As a veteran of the wastewater, trenchless, and civil infrastructure industry, each week I'll be bringing you industry know-how from industry pros who know how. Join me each week as I speak with representatives of organizations that are utilizing disruptive or new technologies and methods, and executives who are excited to share how to be successful and sustainable in our vital industry. So whether you want to learn about the latest trends in technology, in treatment or trenchless, gain tips on training and retaining great talent, or simply how to be more efficient, productive, or profitable, this podcast is for you. Ready? Let's dive right in. Well, hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Doo-Doo Diva Smells Like Money podcast. Today, I am visiting with Chuck Ahrens, a 2+ decades veteran of the wastewater industry. And we're going to be sharing some insights on a number of topics. And so to kick it off, just to lay the groundwork, Chuck, tell the audience a little bit about, you know, your background in the industry and what you've done, and maybe even share some of the things that you've seen that are changing, maybe for the better, maybe for the worst, and take it from there.
Sure. Thanks, Suzanne. I appreciate the introduction. I spent close to 20 years in the industry. The first company was with Shimatsu Scientific, where the two products I sold that went into the industry was TOC, which is total organic carbon, and then also UV-Vis, which is used for looking at algae blooms and other things of that nature. And I spent the bulk of my career with Hawk Company, which is the 400-pound gorilla in the space, selling both into drinking and wastewater facilities. And I'm now with a real small company called CDS Analytical out of Oxford, PA, and they actually make sample introduction equipment for GC mass spec within that space as well.
Okay.
And, you know, some of the big changes I've seen is that the industry has actually shrunk, and I mean the amount of workers, because as people have been leaving, municipalities aren't actually replacing them. And also in talking to operators, one of the biggest issues we're going to be facing in the next 5 to 10 years is a lack of trained operators, because as the operators have been retiring, they're not getting replaced. So if you don't have the people in the laboratory testing the drinking water and the wastewater, how do we know how safe that is, you know, going into our body and then going back out into the water streams? And then how are we to know that the people actually operating the plant aren't the Homer Simpsons in there because they have very little training and they're so overworked? And who knows, maybe the wastewater treatment plant is going to bubble up and we're going to have sewerage all over the streets. So and that's, you know, been my concern and really the thing that I've seen change the most over the last 20 years.
Well, I'm with you there. You know, I do hear that concern about, you know, the labor shortage, and many organizations around the country, you know, WEAs, AWWAs are putting together, you know, workforce development task forces in order to combat that issue. So what are your thoughts? What do you think is coming from, you know, the private side and selling in? Are some things that maybe municipalities could be looking at to fix that problem, you know, for operators? How can we encourage people to consider this as a field on the public side?
Well, and one of the other big changes I've been seeing that I just thought of is that now you have private companies who are getting hired by small municipalities like Suez. They run and also Veolia, which I believe got bought out by Suez not too long ago or so. But you see a lot of these private companies now getting hired and being the operators. But because they're working in a profit, they have very, you know, small skeleton staffs. So again, we're back to the same problem. Do we have enough people in these facilities who are qualified to actually run them? And then how are the labs being staffed? Are they being staffed by people who have a degree in science, who have the background to run the test? Or are we just putting in, you know, operators into the laboratory and asking them to push a button and hopefully we get out good results?
So is it that the career path for operations is not attractive enough, or is it not sufficient funding in order to make this a lucrative opportunity, or a combination of both?
Well, the salary has been anywhere between $60,000 to $65,000 for starting operators, which isn't a bad starting salary. But unless you've been in the field like I have, you don't know that those positions actually exist. Therefore, nobody's really looking to go into them, and you don't see advertising either at the local level or even through headhunters or other agencies looking for people to fill those roles. And, you know, at one point, Penn State in Harrisburg, and I don't know if they still do this, they actually had an operator training program that you could go into. And perhaps maybe this is the type of program that community colleges be offering, because you don't need a four-year degree to become an operator. You may need the four-year degree to actually run the laboratory because of all the scientific knowledge that you need to have and the instrumentation wherewithal and all. But as far as the operators go, I don't see why community colleges aren't looking to put programs together like they have for other industries.
That would be a great place to start, or at least for utilities to approach community colleges and say, hey, we need this. Would you be willing to put up, put together a program with our help and insight? So we put together a very solid program, seems to make sense. But then it's all going to come down to money. And you and I talked about this a little bit offline, in that, you know, it sounds to me like the utilities themselves need to spend a little bit of money on promotion to make themselves look attractive, to get people to say, yeah, maybe I'd like to go work there. But also, these utilities, water and wastewater, man, they're like electricity or phones. I mean, it's essential, probably even more than the phone or the electricity, to our health and well-being. Because without water and wastewater, we're all going to get very sick and we're all going to die. And so you had mentioned to me, out of all the big budgets that come through, sadly, these two key utilities get the least of the lion's share. And I want you to speak on that as to why is that? And what, as we, as constituents, as people in the private sector, as well as in the public sector, how can we change that? What do we need to do to shift that, to get these very important utilities the help they need?
And I think part of the problem is that, you know, as a public person, we all think that every time we turn on the tap, water's just going to mysteriously come out. And most people don't understand the process involved. And like, if you look at a city like New York, a lot of their aquifers are actually upstate New York, and they go through this long and amazing aqueduct. And if you go on the New York City DEP, you can actually find video as to how they actually, you know, put the aqueducts together. And you can see the water running through, and it's all based on gravity. It is an amazing feat of engineering. But nobody really knows about that. So we just think we turn on the tap, we get the water, and everything's okay. And we don't really think about, you know, the process behind getting that water to our tap and, you know, everything just involved. And then if you look at the water cycle, anything that goes down the drain eventually goes back into another waterway, and it gets recycled down the road. Well, if we're not careful about the pollutants that are going in there, we're not going to have clean water, because only about 1% of the entire world's water is actually available for us to use. A lot of it is either tapped on the ground or in glaciers or in other sources that you can't get to. So we have to be really good stewards of that water. And, you know, one of my favorite customers from a large municipality, they used to tell me all the time, we fund 30% of everything that our city does, yet we get the least amount of money. And he goes, the only time we get money to spend is during a drought or a flood. So there has to be some type of extreme condition for them to get the money they want. And then because of the way bureaucracy works, a lot of times they don't get the equipment they want because it's all purchased based on the lowest bid. So as we had mentioned some weeks ago, I had one account where they wound up getting equipment on the lowest bid, and the equipment just really didn't work for them. After about 3 or 4 years, they needed to replace it. To me, that's not a prudent way, you know, a prudent way to spend money. So then they had to go back out to bid, and they really liked the equipment I was selling. And I got to know the superintendent and even one of the commissioners, and they said they were going to bury the cost of the product that they wanted into the rehab of the facility, so it wouldn't have to go out to bid. Now, that kind of circumvents the law, and that shouldn't have to be done. They should let the people running these facilities decide what they want and what's going to be best for them, regardless of what the price is. But that doesn't happen. So, you know, there's such, in my opinion, a huge waste of money when it comes to funding, you know, both of these plants, the water and the wastewater side. And I think the only way around that is to, you know, petition these municipalities to stop doing this bid process and just give them a budget and let them spend it how they see best fit.
I'd like to circle back on that one comment you made that we generate the most revenue for the city budget, but we get the least amount. What did you mean by that? Like, how do they generate the, because of the water bill, the sewer bill?
Yes. The sewer bill, the water bill, all of that then goes into just a general coffers within the municipality or the township. And it gets used however the politicians who are deciding how to spend it want to spend it. It does not, you know, go into a box that says, you know, DEP or water, you know, facility or wastewater facility. It just comes in, goes into a general fund. And then these facilities actually have to basically beg and plead to get money. I mean, I sold a new system into a municipality and they had to beg to get the money. Yet the system that they were running to test the drinking water is close to 12 years old and the company who sold it no longer supported it. You know, it's like putting it together and keeping it running with bubble gum and scotch tape. And that's no way to run a lab.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. So I'd like to segue a little bit, you know, because it all comes down to helping if we are selling equipment and providing, knowing this is the lay of the land. And mm-hmm. we want to do right by our customers, knowing that often they're handcuffed. How can we be good helpers to cities that are struggling to basically, like you were saying, bubble gum and scotch tape? How can we help them until we can change this mindset so that they can actually get what they need or the funds to get what they need? What can we do as a stopgap?
One of the things that I've done, and especially in the smaller municipalities where the government structure isn't so heavy, is I'll go to the town meetings with the superintendent. I'll sit there and I'll listen to them, and I'll even sit next to them and maybe even whisper in their ear or give them a little note. Hey, you need to mention this if this is what you want to get. You have to make this a point as to why it's going to be vital for you to keep the operation up and running and to do the best quality work that you can. But in a large city, say like Allentown or Philadelphia, New York or Boston, trying to get that done is almost nearly impossible because of all the layers of bureaucracy. But what I've always tried to do is to try to at least get to the highest level within that department that I can and speak to them and get to know them and in essence, have them trust me. Because as my first sales manager used to say to me, your job is to get liked and to get liked fast, because when people like you, they trust you, and they trust you, they listen to you. And when they listen to you, they tend to buy. And I've been a trusted advisor in everything that and every company I've ever worked for. And, you know, the best thing I can do for a customer is to help them get what they want. And I'll typically ask them, how can I help you? Tell me what you need from me. Whether it's a little bit of a bigger discount or maybe putting a demo system in there so they can show their management proof of concept. Hey, this works. This really does what we want. We want to buy it. And that's where I've had the most success.
You mentioned that to me is that is the approach that nowadays we really have to take. And we've had to shift into this virtual selling environment, which it makes it even harder to win the trust. You know, because mm-hmm. you don't have that ability to sit down and have a cup of coffee or break bread with someone and develop that face-to-face rapport that here we're in a virtual meeting, just like you and I are on this podcast, is that how does it come across so that that person, that prospect will actually start to trust you or feel like, yes, this is someone that I want to do business with. How have you
for me, that's
gotten past that now? I call it, there was the before COVID and now that we're after the COVID. And so now that, you know, sales and how we approach prospects, that has really changed. So how have you been able to bridge that gap, knowing now that we're more in a virtual environment versus that face-to-face, even though a little bit it's coming back?
Well, The only thing, in my opinion, that's really changed is not being face to face. Doing a video conference call through Teams or Zoom. But the same principle to me still exists. And, it goes back to I have two ears and one mouth for a reason. I need to listen twice as much as I talk. Because unless I can understand what the customer is going through and their pain points and what they want to accomplish at the end of the day, I can't help them. And I can't help them unless I listen to what they have to tell me.
I love that. I love that. Now you said you had a sales manager that said you have to get them to trust you. How do you impart that to other folks that are maybe, if you're a sales manager, to get people to go into that mindset? What are some of the pearls of wisdom that you can share on how do you break the ice? How do you get that prospect to, other than asking the question, to open up? Because many times people don't want to disclose what might be going on in a plant, or they don't want to look like they are less than capable, basically airing the dirty laundry.
Well, and one of my basic questions is, I'm here to help you. What do you need from me? Tell me what you need. And it's just a very simple, basic question. And if they really want your help, they're going to be open and honest about that. If not, then I really can't help them. And do I really want to sell to them then? Because I might wind up having more problems because they may not tell me everything that they need to get done. Therefore, I sell them something that's not going to work for what they really need to accomplish. Now I become the bad guy and they don't want to do business with me. So do I really want to sell in that environment? Probably not.
That's a
So,
real point. Yeah.
and trust becomes a two-way street. If I'm going to trust them to open up to me, they have to realize that they have to trust me, that I'm looking out for their best interest. And, sometimes it doesn't happen, within the first couple of meetings. Sometimes it's months. Sometimes it's years to gain somebody's trust.
And I like that when you said about becoming a trusted advisor wherever you've gone, that has served you well. And it's also just that service after the sale too, that I think is so important in, and not just every industry, but especially ours, because we're kind of like the fire department in the way that, if there's a water main break in the street, we can't say, "Oh, I'm sorry, the truck's broken. We'll get to that in 2 days, when we have a part." No, you've got to be able to deploy now, and it's just that understanding, that sense of urgency that many companies don't. Like, I'm seeing this a lot. I've talked about this with other folks, maybe to get your opinion, since you've been with some pretty big companies, is that there's a lot of M&A, a lot of acquisition and mergers taking place within our industry with companies that are from outside of our industry, and what that's going to mean for our customers. What's your take on that?
I think it's going to be disastrous because I've had managers that knew nothing about the industry in which I was working in and they were managing it. Therefore, when I came to them and said, look, I need to get this done. This is what I need from you. And then it just falls on deaf ears because they don't really feel that my solution is going to help the customer in the long run because they don't even understand what the customer does. And, a lot of managers these days, in my opinion, are too young to be in that position because they haven't been through the trenches. I mean, I've worked for some people that, for the most part, never even sold. How are you supposed to manage me if you've never been out there? It's like, how am I supposed to help a customer in a certain industry if I don't have experience in that industry? And, when I first went to Hawk, I didn't know much about the water industry. I was always telling my customers, I will learn more from you than you will ever learn from me. And, if you need to tell me things that are going on in your plant that I may not understand, I may then turn to you and said, can you explain that to me as though I'm a 3-year-old? Because I don't understand what you do and how this plant operates. And if you can't educate me, I can't help you down the road.
So it's all about asking the right questions too. And I think also what you were just sharing, not being afraid to admit, "I don't know," or "I don't understand. Can you explain that again?" I think that's how we all,
Oh, there's been
yeah, go ahead.
plenty of customers where I'll say to them, I don't know the answer to that. How important is that answer, and when do you need the answer by? This
Mm.
way, they let me know, yeah, it's important. And sometimes they'll say on a scale of 1 to 5, how important is it? Oh, it's a 3. Okay, well, how soon do you need the answer? Because I'll go back to my company and I'll talk to the experts. I'll get the answer for you if it's that important.
Well, in closing, I would just, you know, since you've been in the industry for so long and there's so many innovations that are coming to the forefront right now, you know, in the fields that we are in, what do you find are the ones that utilities should be taking a close look at or keeping their, you know, low bid aside, but new emerging technologies that we should be keeping our eye on? Or really considering as we continue on, that maybe can help with the fact that we're going to have fewer people available in the short run. Well, hopefully this problem is going to resolve itself, but that we are going to be looking at a labor shortage for a while that can help us get through this.
I think the best investment that they can make right now is in a good AI program that does predictive analysis. Because that's in essence what the operators have been trained to do, to look at the board and determine, oh, we're going to have this problem. Maybe not today, maybe in a couple of days, maybe in a week. What do we need to do to fix it now? So if they can get a program that can predict that and let them know, hey, because of what's happening upstream, this is going to happen downstream if you don't fix it, they won't need as many people to run the plant.
Thank you. That's a really good one. And so, Chuck, I want to thank you for sharing your expertise and your thoughts and your opinion. I mean, just your wisdom for all the decades in the industry. And so Chuck is open to connections on LinkedIn. It's under, if I'm not mistaken, it's Charles and in brackets, Chuck Ahrens, and that's Ahrens. And for those who might be interested in learning more about what Chuck does and the technology that he is representing in his company, could you please give us that website address so they can check that
out?
Sure.
It's, of course, www.cds, as in Charles David Sam, analytics.com. You know, and again, located in Oxford, Pennsylvania, just outside of Philly.
Now, does this company provide these services just in that regional area, or is it nationwide, international?
Well, we're global, and the three main products we sell is a purge and trap, which actually analyzes water for volatile organic compounds, thermal desorption, which is used in the industrial hygiene, looking at air pollutants or other compounds like that, and then a pyrolysis system, which, you know, is really used heavily in the forensic science industry, as well as tobacco and then plastic manufacturers. And I was recently down at a plastic recycling conference where, unfortunately, pyrolysis for recycling plastic is so expensive, there's not a lot of companies doing that. But that would actually bring the plastic back to its natural state, almost to the point of being back to oil where it can be reused again.
Wow, fascinating.
But that technology is so expensive. Only the big players like BASF and Exxon and others like that are actually using pyrolysis to recycle the plastic.
All right. Well, again, Chuck, I want to thank you for being on the show. And thank you, audience, for tuning in to this week's episode. And until next time, keep it flowing. Thanks so much for joining me, the Doo-Doo Diva, on this week's episode of Smells Like Money. What stood out to you this week? Share your takeaways by leaving me a review. You can find out more about the new technologies, creating sustainable solutions and insights on how to succeed in our vital industry by subscribing to the show. Whether you want to learn about the latest trends in wastewater infrastructure, treatment, or trenchless, you've got it all right here at Smells Like Money. If you're an industry expert and would like to be considered as a guest for the show, book a quick chat with me by visiting calendly.com/thetuitgroup/B-A-podcast-guest, or simply click the link in the show notes below. Until next week, a big shout out to all my industry friends and those who will be. You are my superheroes. Thanks for tuning in, keeping it flowing, and we'll see you all next week.